Testing 1, 2, 3. I think that's working. Testing. I hope that's working. It's the default device. I think that's the setting to use, so let's hope that works. Okay. Oh, Carol is asking for the link to the to the course, Political Economy of War. So I'll post it again. I think that's the link she's asking for. There it is. Okay, and I'll start reading. Posting this recording. I'll be posting it on the Oh, okay. Now you see it. Okay, I see what you're saying. You're looking for that link. All right. Chapter 12. The Socialist Roots of Nazism. All anti-liberal forces are combining against everything that is liberal. A. Moller van den Broek. It is a common mistake to regard National Socialism as a mere revolt against reason, an irrational movement without intellectual background. If that were so, the movement would be much less dangerous than it is. But nothing could be further from the truth or more misleading. The doctrines of National Socialism are the culmination of a long evolution of thought, a process in which thinkers who have had great influence far beyond the confines of Germany have taken part. Whatever one may think of the premises from which they started, it cannot be denied that the men who produced the new doctrines were powerful writers, who left the impress of their ideas on the whole of European thought. Their system was developed with ruthless consistency. Once one accepts the premises from which it starts, there is no escape from its logic. It is simply collectivism, freed from all traces of an individualist tradition which might hamper its realization. Though in this development German thinkers have taken the lead, they were by no means alone. Thomas Carlyle and Houston Stuart Chamberlain, Auguste Comte and Georges Sorel are as much a part of that continuous development as any Germans. The development of this strand of thought within Germany has been well traced recently by R.D. Butler in his study of The Roots of National Socialism. That'll be a good read. But although its persistence there through 150 years in almost unchanged and ever-recurring form, which emerges from that study, is rather frightening, it is easy to exaggerate the importance these ideas had in Germany before 1914. They were only one strand of thought among a people when perhaps more varied in its views than any other. Mises has a good chapter in Omnipotent Government where he talks about German liberalism, that often people think of Germany as just the land of totalitarian thought, and that's all that it has produced, but it's not true. It's just that the totalitarians won in the end. And they were, well, not the end, but, you know, before, with Bismarck and Hitler and all that. And they were, on the whole, represented by a small minority and held in as great contempt by the majority of Germans as they were in other countries. What then caused these views held by a reactionary minority finally to gain the support of the great majority of Germans and practically the whole of her youth? It was not merely a defeat. The suffering and the wave of nationalism which led to their success. Still less was the cause, as so many people wish to believe, a capitalist reaction against the advance of socialism. On the contrary, the support which brought these ideas to power came precisely from the socialist camp. It was certainly not through the bourgeois, and rather through the absence of a strong bourgeois, that they were helped to power. The doctrines which had guided the ruling elements in Germany for the past generation were opposed not to the socialism and Marxism, but to the liberal elements contained in it, its internationalism and its democracy. And as it became increasingly clear that it was just these elements which formed obstacles to the realization of socialism, the socialists of the left approached more and more to those of the right. It was the union of the anti-capitalist forces of the right and of the left, the fusion of radical and conservative socialism, which drove out from Germany everything that was liberal. The connection between socialism and nationalism in Germany was close. Oh, and this goes back to what he just said there, goes back to what he said at the beginning of The Road to Serfdom, when he was talking about left socialists and the right socialists, the national socialists and the international socialists. They looked at each other like a fascist looks at the Marxist as a potential convert, because really they're made of the same cloth. Whereas the socialists of all parties, whereas it was the liberal with whom people, especially people like Hitler, it was the liberals who Hitler detested the most. And it was just that by the time Hitler rose to power, the liberals were already mostly defeated and gone, so his loathing of the liberals didn't really have, an excuse to come out. But really, those were the people with whom socialists of all parties had nothing in common. The connection between socialism and nationalism in Germany was close from the beginning. It is significant that the most important ancestors of National Socialism, Fichte, Robertus, and LaSalle, are at the same time acknowledged fathers of socialism. While theoretical socialism in its Marxist form was directing the German labor movement, the authoritarian and nationalist element receded for a time into the background. But not for long. From 1914 onward, there arose from the ranks of Marxist socialism one teacher after another who led, not the conservatives and reactionaries, but the hard-working laborer and idealist youth into the National Socialist fold. It was only thereafter that the tide of nationalist socialism attained major importance and rapidly grew into the Hitlerian doctrine. The war hysteria of 1914, which, just because of the German defeat, was never fully cured, is the beginning of the modern development which produced National Socialism, and it was largely the assistance of old socialists that it rose during this period. Perhaps the first, and in some ways the most characteristic representative of this development, is the late Professor Werner Sombart, whose notorious Handler und Helden, Merchants and Heroes, appeared in 1915. Now, Mises talks about Sombart in Human Action. That quote I put earlier of how the Marxians thought of the two social orders as the Gentile order, the Gentile socialist order versus the evil capitalist order, that same dichotomy has been portrayed by Sombart as merchants versus heroes. And then I think he also talks about Nietzsche discussing the dichotomy of Nietzsche really also glorified the heroes of ancient Greece, and then Herbert Spencer also that same distinction, but with different terminology. Very different people, all those thinkers.
That's a wrap.
Sorry about that. That was the recorder. Sombart had begun as a Marxian socialist, and as late as 1909 could assert with pride that he had devoted the greater part of his life to fighting for the ideas of Karl Marx. He had done as much as any man to spread socialist ideas and anti-capitalist resentment of varying shades throughout Germany. And if German thought became penetrated with Marxian elements in a way that was true of no other country until the Russian Revolution, this was in large measure due to Sombart. At one time, he was regarded as the outstanding representative of the persecuted socialist intelligentsia, unable, because of his radical views, to obtain a university chair. And even after the last war, the influence inside and outside Germany of his work as a historian, which remained Marxist in approach after he had ceased to be a Marxist in politics, was most extensive and is particularly noticeable in the works of many of the English and American planners. In his war book, this old socialist welcomed the, quote, German War as the inevitable conflict between the commercial civilization of England and the heroic culture of Germany. This contempt for England goes back to, I forgot who it was that dismissed Elizabethan England as a nation of shopkeepers. His contempt for the commercial views of the English people, who had lost all warlike instincts, is unlimited. Nothing is more contemptible in his eyes than the universal striving after the happiness of the individual. And what he describes as the leading maxim of English morals, be just, quote, that it may be well with thee, and that thou mayest prolong thy days upon the land, close quote, is to him, quote, the most infamous maxim which has ever been pronounced by a commercial mind. The, quote, German idea of the state, close quote, as formulated by Fichte, LaSalle, and Robertus, is that the state is neither founded nor formed by individuals, nor an aggregate of individuals, nor is its purpose to serve any interest of individuals. It is a Volksgemeinschaft, in which the individual has no rights, but only duties. Claims of the individual are always an outcome of the commercial spirit. Quote, the ideas of 1789, close quote, of the French Revolution, liberty, equality, fraternity, are characteristically commercial ideas, which have no other purpose but to secure certain advantages to individuals. Before 1914, all the German ideals of a heroic life were in deadly danger before the continuous advance of English commercial ideals, English comfort, and English sport. The English people had not only themselves become completely corrupted, every trade unionist being sunk in the, quote, morass of comfort, close quote, but they had begun to infect all other peoples. Only the war had helped the Germans to remember that they were really a people of warriors, a people among whom all activities, and particularly all economic activities, were subordinated to military ends. There's a famous Bismarck quote where he says, like, the rise of Prussia or Germany, I don't know which one he said, will be not in dollars and cents, maybe, but in blood. I know that last part is true. Sombart knew that the Germans were held in contempt by other people because they regard war as sacred, but he glories in it. To regard war as inhuman and senseless is a product of commercial views. There is a life higher than the individual life, the life of the people, and the life of the state, and it is the purpose of the individual to sacrifice himself for that higher life. Now, Mises has a whole whole part of human action completely destroying this view. It's called a critique of the holistic view of society or something like that. If you search in human action for critique and holistic, you can find that. War is to Sombart the consummation of the heroic view of life, and the war against England is the war against the opposite ideal, the commercial ideal of individual freedom and of English comfort, which in his eyes finds its most contemptible expression in the safety razors found in the English trenches. If Sombart's outburst was at the time too much even for most Germans, another German professor arrived at essentially the same ideas in a more moderate and more scholarly, but for that reason even more effective form. Professor Johann Plenge was as great an authority on Marx as Sombart. His book on Marx und Hegel marks the beginning of the modern Hegel Renaissance among Marxian scholars, and there can be no doubt about the genuinely socialist nature of the convictions with which he started. Among his numerous war publications, the most important is a small and at the time widely discussed book with a significant title, 1789 and 1914, which is, of course, the years of the French Revolution and World War I, the symbolic years in the history of the political mind. It is devoted to the conflict between the, quote, ideas of 1789, close quote, the ideal of freedom, and the, quote, the ideas of 1914, the ideal of organization. Organization is to him, as to all socialists who derive their socialism from a crude application of scientific ideals to the problems of society, the essence of socialism. It was, as he rightly emphasizes, the root of the socialist movement at its inception in early 19th century France. Marx and Marxism have betrayed this basic idea of socialism by their fanatic but utopian adherence to the abstract idea of freedom. Only now was the idea of organization again coming into its own, elsewhere as witnessed by the work of H.G. Wells, by whose Future in America Professor Plenge was profoundly influenced, and whom he describes as one of the most outstanding figures of modern socialism, but particularly in Germany, where it is best understood and most fully realized. The war between England and Germany is therefore really a conflict between two opposite principles. The economic world war is the third great epoch of spiritual struggle in modern history. It is of equal importance with the Reformation and the bourgeois revolution of liberty. It is the struggle for the victory of the new forces born out of the advanced economic life of the 19th century, socialism and organization. Quote, because in the sphere of ideas, Germany was the most convinced exponent of all socialist dreams, and in the sphere of reality, she was the most powerful architect of the most highly organized economic system. In us is the 20th century. However the war may end, we are the exemplary people. Our ideas will determine the aims of the life of humanity. World history experiences at present the colossal spectacle that with us a new great ideal of life penetrates to final victory, while at the same time in England, one of the world historical principles finally collapses. Close quote. The war economy created in Germany in 1914, quote, is the first realization of a socialist society, and its spirit the first active and not merely demanding appearance of a socialist spirit. The needs of the war have established the socialist idea in German economic life, and thus the defense of our nation produced for humanity the idea of 1914, the idea of German organization, the people's community, Volksgemeinschaft, of National Socialism. Without our really noticing it, the whole of our political life in state and industry has risen to a higher stage. State and economic life form a new unity. The feeling of economic responsibility, which characterizes the work of a civil servant, pervades all private activity. Close quote. The new German cooperative constitution of economic life, which Professor Plenge admits is not yet ripe or complete, quote, is the highest form of life of the state which has ever been known on Earth. At first, Professor Plenge still hoped to reconcile the ideal of liberty and the ideal of organization, although largely through the complete but voluntary submission of the individual to the whole. But these traces of liberal ideas soon disappear from his writings. By 1918, the union between socialism and ruthless power politics had become complete in his mind. Shortly before the end of the war, he exhorted his compatriots in the socialist journal Die Glocke in the following manner. Quote, "It is time to recognize the fact that socialism must be power policy, because it is to be organization. Socialism has to win power. It must never blindly destroy power. And the most important and critical question for socialism in the time of war of peoples is necessarily this: what people is preeminently summoned to power because it is the exemplary leader in the organization of peoples?" Close quote. And he forecast all the ideas which were finally to justify Hitler's new order. Quote, "Just from the point of view of socialism, which is organization, is not an absolute right of self-determination of the peoples the right of individualistic economic anarchy? Are we willing to grant complete self-determination to the individual in economic life? Consistent socialism can accord to the people a right to incorporation only in accordance with the real distribution of forces historically determined." Close quote. So it's interesting, in this one man you can really see the evolution of the socialist left to the socialist right. The ideals which Plenge expressed, Rothbard has a great essay where he characterizes socialists as sort of like middle of the roaders. It's a really interesting thesis. And that really the poles are liberty and kind of like right socialism. The ideals which Plenge expressed so clearly were especially popular among, and perhaps even derived from, certain circles of German scientists and engineers, who, precisely as is now so loudly demanded by their English and American counterparts, clamored for the centrally planned organization of all aspects of life. Leading among these was the famous chemist Wilhelm Ostwald, one of whose pronouncements on this point of view has achieved a certain celebrity. He is reported to have stated publicly that, quote, "Germany wants to organize Europe, which up to now still lacks organization. I will explain to you now Germany's great secret. We, or perhaps the German race, have discovered the significance of organization. While the other nations still live under the regime of individualism, we have already achieved that of organization." Close quote. Ideas very similar to these were current in the offices of the German raw material dictator Walther Rathenau, who, although he would have shuddered had he realized the consequences of his totalitarian economics, yet deserves a considerable place in any fuller history of the growth of Nazi ideas. Through his writings, he has probably, more than any other man, determined the economic views of the generation which grew up in Germany during and immediately after the last war. And some of his closest collaborators were later to form the backbone of the staff of Goring's five-year plan administration. Very similar also was much of the teaching of another former Marxist, Friedrich Naumann, whose Mitteleuropa reached probably the greatest circulation of any war book in Germany. But it was left to the active socialist politician, a member of the left wing of the Socialist Democratic Party in the Reichstag, to develop these ideas most fully and to spread them far and wide. Paul Lentsch had already in earlier books described the war as, quote, the flight of the English bourgeoisie before the advance of socialism, close quote, and explained how different were the socialist ideal of freedom and the English conception. But only in this third and most successful war book, his 3 years of world revolution, were his characteristic ideas under the influence of Plenge to achieve full development. Lentsch bases his argument on an interesting and in many respects accurate historical account of how the adoption of protection by Bismarck had made possible in Germany a development toward that industrial concentration and cartelization which, from his Marxist standpoint, represented a higher state of industrial development. Quote, the result of Bismarck's decision of the year 1879 was that Germany took on the role of the revolutionary, that is to say, of a state whose position in relation to the rest of the world is that of a representative of a higher and more advanced economic system. Having realized this, we should perceive that in the present world revolution, Germany represents the revolutionary, and her greatest antagonist, England, the counter-revolutionary side. This fact proves how little the constitution of a country, whether it be liberal and republican or monarchic and autocratic, affects the question whether, from the point of view of historical development, that country is to be regarded as liberal or not. Or, to put it more plainly, our conception of liberalism, democracy, and so forth, are derived from the ideas of English individualism, according to which a state with a weak government is a liberal state, and every restriction upon the freedom of the individual is conceived as the product of autocracy and militarism. Close quote. In Germany, the historically appointed representative of this higher form of economic life, quote, the struggle for socialism has been extraordinarily simplified, since all the prerequisite conditions of socialism had already become established there, and hence it was necessarily a vital concern of any socialist party that Germany should triumphantly hold her own against her enemies, and thereby be able to fulfill her historic mission of revolutionizing the world. Hence the War of the Entente against Germany resembled the attempt of the lower bourgeoisie of the pre-capitalist age to prevent the decline of their own class. Close quote. That organization of capital, Lentsch continues, quote, which began unconsciously before the war, and which during the war has been continued consciously, will be systematically continued after the war, not through any desire for any arts of organization, nor yet because socialism has been recognized as a higher principle of social development. The classes who are today the practical pioneers of socialism are, in theory, its avowed opponents, or at any rate were so up to a short time ago. Socialism is coming, and, in fact, has to come, has to some extent already arrived, since we can no longer live without it. Close quote. The only people who still oppose this tendency are the liberals. Quote, this class of people who unconsciously reason from English standards comprises the whole educated German bourgeoisie. Their political notions of freedom and civic right, of constitutionalism and parliamentarianism, are derived from that individualistic conception of the world, of which English liberalism is a classical embodiment, and which was adopted by the spokesmen of the German bourgeoisie in the 50s, 60s, and 70s of the 19th century. But these standards are old-fashioned and shattered, just as old-fashioned English liberalism has been shattered by this war. What has to be done now is to get rid of these inherited political ideas and to assist the growth of a new conception of state and society. In this sphere, also, socialism must present a conscious and determined opposition to individualism. In this connection, it is an astonishing fact that in the so-called reactionary Germany, the working classes have won for themselves a much more solid and powerful position in the life of the state than is the case either in England or in France. Close quote. Lenz follows this up with a consideration which, again, contains much truth and which deserves to be pondered. Quote, since the Social Democrats, by the aid of this universal suffrage, occupied every post which they must obtain in the Reichstag, the state parliament, the municipal councils, the courts for the settlement of trade disputes, the sick funds, and so forth, they penetrated very deeply into the organization of the state. But the price which they had to pay for this was that the state in its turn exercised a profound influence upon the working classes. To be sure, as the result of strenuous socialistic labors for 50 years, the state is no longer the same as it was in the year 1867, when universal suffrage first came into operation. But then, social democracy, in its turn, is no longer the same as it was at the time. The state has undergone a process of socialization, and social democracy has undergone a process of nationalization. Plenge and Lenz, in turn, have provided the leading ideas for the immediate masters of National Socialism, particularly Oswald Spengler and Arthur Moeller van den Broek, to mention only the two best-known names. Opinions may differ in how far the former can be regarded as a socialist, but that, in his tract on Prussianism and Socialism, which appeared in 1920, he merely gave expression to ideas widely held by German socialists will now be evident. A few specimens of his argument will suffice. Quote, old Prussian spirit and socialist conviction, which today hate each other with a hatred of brothers, are one and the same. Close quote. The representatives of Western civilization in Germany, the German liberals, are, quote, the invisible English army which after the Battle of Jena, Napoleon left behind on German soil. Close quote. To Spengler, men like Hardenberg and Humboldt and all the other liberal reformers were, quote, English. But this English spirit will be turned out by the German Revolution, which began in 1914. The three last nations of the Occident have aimed at three forms of existence, represented by famous watchwords, freedom, equality, community. They appear in the political forms of liberal parliamentarianism, social democracy, and authoritarian socialism. The German, so the matching that he does there is that for freedom, equality, community, freedom is associated with parliamentarianism, equality is associated with social democracy, and community is associated with authoritarian socialism. The German, more correctly, Prussian, instinct is the power belongs to the whole. Everyone is given his place. One commands or obeys. This is, since the 18th century, authoritarian socialism, essentially illiberal and anti-democratic, insofar as English liberalism and French democracy are met. There are in Germany many hated and ill-reputed contrasts, but liberalism alone is contemptible on German soil. The structure of the English nation is based on the distinction between rich and poor, that of the Prussian on that between command and obedience. The meaning of class distinction is accordingly fundamentally different in the two countries. Close quote. After pointing out the essential difference between the English competitive system and the Prussian system of, quote, economic administration, close quote, and after showing, consciously following Lynch, how since Bismarck, the deliberate organization of economic activity had progressively assumed more socialist forms, Spengler continues. In Prussia, there existed a real state in the most ambitious meaning of the word. There could be, strictly speaking, no private persons. Everybody who lived within the system that worked with the precision of a clockwork was in some way a link in it. The conduct of public business could therefore not be in the hands of private people, as is supposed by parliamentarianism. It was an amt, and the responsible politician was a civil servant, a servant of the whole. Close quote. The Prussian idea requires that everybody should become a state official, that all wages and salaries be fixed by the state. The administration of all property, in particular, becomes a salaried function. The state of the future will be a Beamtenstaat, but, quote, the decisive question, not only for Germany, but for the world, which must be solved by Germany for the world, is in the future trade to govern the state, or the state to govern trade? In the face of this question, Prussianism and socialism are the same. Prussianism and socialism combat the England in our midst. Close quote. It was only a step from this for the patron saint of National Socialism, Möller van den Broek, to proclaim world war between liberalism and socialism. Quote, we have lost the war against the West. Socialism has lost it against liberalism. As with, close quote, as with Spengler, liberalism is therefore the archenemy. Möller van den Broek glories in the fact that, quote, there are no liberals in Germany today. There are young revolutionaries. There are young conservatives. But who would be liberal? Liberalism is a philosophy of life from which German youth now turns with nausea, with wrath, with quite peculiar scorn, for there is none more foreign, more repugnant, more opposed to its philosophy. German youth today recognizes the liberal as the arch enemy. Close quote. Möller van den Broek's Third Reich was intended to give the Germans a socialism adapted to their nature and undefiled by Western liberal ideas. And so it did. These writers were by no means isolated phenomena. As early as 1922, a detached observer could speak of, quote, a peculiar and on a first glance surprising phenomenon, close quote, then to be observed in Germany. Quote, the fight against the capitalistic order, according to this view, is a continuation of the war against the Entente with the weapons of the spirit and of economic organization, the way which leads to practical socialism, a return of the German people to their best and noblest traditions. Close quote. Fight against liberalism in all its forms, liberalism that had defeated Germany, was the common idea which united socialists and conservatives in one common front. At first, it was mainly in the German youth movement, almost entirely socialist in inspiration and outlook, where these ideas were most readily accepted and the fusion of socialism and nationalism completed. In the later 20s, and until the advent to power of Hitler, a circle of young men gathered round the journal Die Tat and led by Ferdinand Freud became the chief exponent of this tradition in the intellectual sphere. Freud's End des Kapitalismus is perhaps the most characteristic product of this group, of Edelnazis, as they were known in Germany, and is particularly disquieting because of its resemblance to so much of the literature which we see in England and the United States today, where we can watch the same drawing together of the socialist left and the right, and nearly the same contempt of all that is liberal in the old sense. Quote, conservative socialism, close quote, and in other circles, quote, religious socialism, close quote, was the slogan under which a large number of writers prepared the atmosphere in which national socialism succeeded. It is conservative socialism which is the dominant trend among us now. Had the war against the Western powers, quote, with the weapons of the spirit and of economic organization, close quote, not almost succeeded before the real war began? And thus did England and the United States lose the war in winning it. So, thank you for listening, and I hope you have a good night. See you in the forums. Bye.